Well, thank you to David Grose for making the observation that my whole career is a sequence of improbable combinations of topics. So this is about VQE, which is a leading application of NISQ algorithms. So NISQ is a term invented by John Preskill, meaning noisy intermediate scale quantum. I thought I'd just start off with my little attempt to define in a more rigorous way what that actually means. So we just had this announcement of quantum supremacy, which is another Preskillism. So anything less than 53 qubits, let's assume that you can do that with a very large classical computer. This is, by the way, error rate. This is number of qubits. So if you're below the threshold for some code, you can't do error correction. However, as we all know, if you have 53 qubits and you're right at threshold, you can't make a single error corrected qubit anyway. So there's some, you know, number of qubits you need. I know that this curve is not remotely correct, but this is a cartoon. There's some number of qubits you need to make one error corrected qubit. So you will notice that there is this irritating triangle, which is where we are now and probably will be for the next decade. So I know there's a lot of people here who work on error correction who, you know, maybe legitimately irritated by NISQ work, but it sort of doesn't matter. This is what we're going to have for the next decade. It's what's for dinner. We might as well think about it. And then eventually we'll be through this desert of NISQ stuff and we'll be able to build a real quantum computer. And of course, the first things we'll do when we have a small fault-tolerant quantum computer is all the stuff we've been doing here. So we might as well think about small applications. So what are these like? Well, all variational quantum algorithms pretty much fall into just prepare and measure experiments. So you build some ansatz state, you perform some measurement, you feed the results of your measurement back to some classical computer, you change your ansatz state, and away you go. And the hope is that you can realize, you know, as Rob was saying, you can realize probability distributions more efficiently with a short quantum circuit, and that noise doesn't kill you, and so on. So VQE, which is what I'll mainly talk about today, was invented in the context of chemistry. This is a rather arty representation of doing quantum chemistry on a quantum computer that my student Monica Kishori made, which I use at every opportunity. This is a, sorry about the font size here. So there's just some procedure that is now extremely well established and has been encoded in Open Fermion, which is one of Google's open source products. So you now can go, anybody can download that. You can make qubit Hamiltonians that represent various molecular species. And you can implement those as variational quantum eigensolver procedures and try to solve them on some NISQ device or simulated NISQ device. So what do we do? All of that stuff just translates a chemistry problem or a condensed matter problem or something into a Hamiltonian that's just a linear combination of Pauli operators, where throughout this talk, I'm going to refer to the set of Paulis defined in the Hamiltonian just as S. Okay? And all we do in this procedure is just variationally minimize the expectation value of H by variationally minimizing each of the expectations of the Paulis. So each of these is computed in a separate experiment. And then you add them up with weights, and you've taken this beautiful dream of having a wonderful many-qubit fault-tolerant quantum computer doing some beautiful quantum simulation algorithm, like a Beethoven symphony. And this is a bit more like, you know, a punk rock song. It's all sort of short circuits and four-letter words. But this is, as I say, this was invented because we, you know, those of us who were interested in trying to do chemistry 10 years ago kept asking to do phase estimation and kept getting told no. So this you can do now. Just a couple of comments. So classically, you might ask, why don't I try and do this? I should be able to minimize this just by optimizing the reduced density matrix that's the support of that Pauli matrix. If you do that, you will run off to negative infinity in the energy. That's because you will be creating reduced density matrices that don't correspond to some global quantum state. That's called the n-representability problem in chemistry. It was shown to be equivalent to local Hamiltonian in complexity by Frank Vistrati and Yikai Liu. Quantumly, of course, what you're really doing is just using the one thing you hope this dirty quantum computer can do, which is maintain a global quantum state.
Do you assume that your terms are of small weight or local?
Good question. So when you do this for chemistry problems, these Paulis are logarithmically local in the number of qubits. And the weights, you don't assume are small. And typically the size of S for quantum chemistry is sort of the fourth power of the number of qubits, so it can be big, which is a problem I'll come back to a bit later. Okay, so the main reason, as I said, to develop VQE was to do experiments. So they've now been, this is the first one that was done with Jeremy O'Brien's group in when he was in Bristol before he vanished into the whatever it is Psi Quantum are doing. This is one that was done at Innsbruck with Cornelius Hempel, who's down in Australia. And here's one from Google and one from IBM, just to show we love our corporate overlords equally. Here's the, you know, the photonic chip, a couple of pictures of the superconducting things, and this is, of course, ions fluorescing in a trap. Those are not the actual ions that were used, but all particles are, universe is made of identical particles, so they'll do. Okay, so VQE is not the only algorithm of this type. There's also the quantum approximate optimization algorithm, QAOA, which was invented by Eddie Fahey after he fell down the stairs and had to spend 7 weeks in bed.
Is that a true story?
That's true, yeah. So what do? We just restrict H to include some classical combinatorial optimization problem like max cut. So you can do that by putting a clause, a single Hamiltonian term of Pauli weight 2 on the edge of a graph. You maximize that, you find a good approximation to the max cut. And here, unlike in VQE, where you use some physically motivated ansatz or whatever your hardware can do, here you have a specific form for the ansatz. You have one round of applying the clauses from your classical Hamiltonian and one round of local Pauli terms. Okay. So where is, I was just saying this to David Gossett 20 minutes ago, you can think that the purpose of inventing VQE was to do experiments and try and demonstrate some of these calculations. Really, the purpose of QAOA was to prove theorems and to try and do calculations, because this is simple enough that you can actually analyze it and bound the approximation ratio, which is the ratio of the answer you can get with QAOA to the true answer. And I guess the status of QAOA is that they did manage to demonstrate the best known approximation ratio for some variant of SAT. And then all the computer scientists, all the famous computer scientists in the world, like 11 of them, got together and created a classical algorithm that beat that result. Okay, so what questions can we ask about these algorithms? So the first, most obvious question is, can they be simulated classically? So David Gossett will talk about, this is the wrong number of T's.
Yeah, no, that's right.
That's right. So one of the measurements really quantum, that's what this talk is about. And then, you know, if you are an investor in quantum startups, this is what you want to know. So let's just wait. We'll know the answer to this in 10 years. So can we actually, without error correction, do something with a quantum computer that's useful that you can't do with a classical computer? We don't know, but I think we'll know from experiment. Okay, so thinking about the ansatz state introduces a whole bunch of mess. So let's just start very simple, and let's just ask the following question. I have this set of measurements I want to make. When can I do the thing that we know you usually can't do in quantum mechanics, which is pre-assign the measurement outcomes? So I start with my Hamiltonian. I take the set of terms, S. So now I'm just going to make an assignment to S, which is just a mapping from the label of the term to plus or minus 1. And now that's not enough. I have to think about the fact that if I'm assigning to S, then I'm also assigning to any observable that can be inferred from S, which is any product from an abelian subset of S. So I have to take the what's called the closure under inference of S, which we call S over bar. So that's what you call the smallest closed subtheory in the language of this paper. So that's what we're doing. If we're thinking about classically pre-assigning our measurement outcomes, we have to be able to assign all of these possible measurements without there being a contradiction. So, of course, we know very well from the Perez-Mermin square that, in general, you can't do that. So we're trying to do something that, in general, you can't do. What we're going to do is ask, when can you do it? So the useful trick, or the useful technique that my student Will Kirby used in this work was the idea of a determining tree. So we start with our set S here. They're at the bottom, so they're children of some parents. And unlike in biology, parents are the product of their children. So I just multiply them together to get the parents. Actually, if you are a parent, you are also the product of your children. And then I keep multiplying up. And then I get the root of the tree. And so the root is in S bar, S over bar, if it has a determining tree over S. This is just a way of labeling products of operators. OK, so obviously there's more than one determining tree. Here's the one I just wrote down. But I can mess around with the order of the products. And I can get, for example, this determining tree. And now, obviously, I have a problem. Because if I assign yy based on the left-hand determining tree, I'm going to make the opposite assignation based on the right-hand determining tree. And so all we've done is just reproduce. Instead of writing a square table, now we have two trees. This is just the Perez-Mermin square obstacle to assigning this set of observables. OK, so now we can say, just to introduce some language, so any set S of terms is contextual if one can write a determining tree for A and for minus A for some observable A. So it just means there is, hidden inside this set of observables, some kind of Perez-Mermin obstacle. OK, it's getting close to Christmas, so. So here are your presents, and you get an angel, or you get negative an angel on top of the tree. So any set, okay, so I guess I'm saying the same thing again, just to make a Christmas joke. And it, when you can do this, you can always produce this contradiction inside S. All right, so how do we...
You get on top of a turkey. Sorry. No. Have Christmas yet. Apologize.
I was holding myself back from making some anti-European joke about different traditions. But, so how do we determine this without drawing a whole forest of determining trees? What we want to look at is products from commuting sets, so it's natural to look at the compatibility graph. This is a compatibility graph for two qubits. Not a very pretty picture, sorry. So this is just a graph where the vertices of the graph are the operators, and there's an edge present between two operators if that pair of operators commutes. So what we can say is the following result, which you can prove by a long exercise with determining trees, that S is non-contextual if the compatibility graph lacks the following three subgraphs. So for every quadruple of terms, you can't have a pair, you can't have a triple like this, and you can't have a square. And we were a bit nervous about this when we wrote it down, and then we were super happy when Robert and his collaborators introduced the same structure in the context of Wigner functions for qubits. So it's always very reassuring to see the same thing independently discovered. Okay, so there's a slightly easier way of thinking about this. If you take your set S and remove any Casimirs, i.e. any terms that commute with everything in S, what this enforces is that commutation is then an equivalence relation on that set S. Okay, meaning, you know, if you have a structure like this, then in your compatibility graph, then that one has to be filled in. And so if you think about what that implies about the structure of the graph with the completely commuting set terms removed, in general, there won't be any completely commuting terms. So I have a bunch of points. Well, okay, suppose there's one here, and there's one here. Well, now there has to be one here. Suppose this triangle is connected here. Well, now there has to be one here. Oh, now there has to be one here. And so the compatibility spreads like an infection, okay? So what you end up with is a bunch of disjoint cliques in your compatibility. Okay, so how did our experimental colleagues do if we apply this test to all the experiments that have been done over the last 10-ish years now? So you can see that it's about 50-50. All of the early experiments fail this test, okay? And fortunately, all the recent experiments pass this test. This is quite strict, right? And there's a very good reason why the top half of this table says no. And that is that most of these are the hydrogen molecule, but when you do a simulation of a molecule in quantum chemistry, you have to impose a basis. So these are what are called minimal basis simulations of the hydrogen molecule. And that means there are essentially two states that are active in the calculation. There's a bonding state and an antibonding state, which means that the whole problem is a complicatedly encoded single qubit problem. And of course, there's no contextuality in a single qubit. There's also a kind of historically amusing fact about these experiments. For ages, I and Alain Aspin-Guzik and various other people and anyone we could bribe or persuade would nag every experimentalist we could find to do this experiment. So now we've published a nice paper criticizing them for doing what we were nagging them for 5 years to do. In fact, when Alain interviewed at Harvard, Tony Dutoit and I were down the street at MIT in David Corey's lab, sitting there for 2 days trying to work out how to do this in NMR, which we never succeeded in doing. And then the first day we were on our own, and then Alain came back. And after you've been interviewed for a faculty position at Harvard, you are mentally dead. So we were still there working away at this problem, and Alain was sitting there going, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it was very irritating. But then he got the job. So that's okay, so what are the other columns? These are all due to, actually, the referees on this paper were very nice. So the first referee referred to this as a lowbrow thing to do, which I thought was quite amusing, to make a table of experiments. But so these are just counting the fraction of the terms in S that you would have to throw away to make the set non-contextual, okay? So for this is the Schwinger model, which is just a very simple model in high energy physics. So here you have to throw away 16%, and then when you come down to this IBM experiment, you have to throw away about 75% of them. And then here's the number of terms in the set that are being measured. So you can see things have gone up from very small numbers to around 100 or a couple of hundred. Okay. So, what have we said? Call a Hamiltonian non-contextual if its S is. If its S is. If the set S is non-contextual and the Hamiltonian is non-contextual. It was late. I'm making these late last night, sorry. Okay, so QAOA is obviously non-contextual in this sense. So the way to think about non-contextual VQE is just sort of equivalent to QAOA. which is not to say there's not going to be a quantum advantage looking at Hamiltonians of that type, but if there is, it has to come from some clever quantum ansatz that's reproducing the expectation values of the observables more efficiently than you could with a classical model. So the obvious question is there some kind of non-contextual inspired classical algorithm for the non-contextual VQE? And we're sort of working on that. We have most of a sort of quasi-quantized or epistricted, should all start saying epistricted, it's a really fun word to say. So this is work by Rob Speckens, where you take us, you have really a set of ontic states, which are your assignments to the independent observables in S, and then you impose a classical uncertainty principle on them by restricting what probability distributions are allowed over those ontic states in such a way that you correctly reproduce the expectation values corresponding to quantum states. Of course, this can't be an efficient algorithm, because in both QAOA and in non-contextual VQE, you can encode NP complete problems. So we just are reducing it to a classical optimization problem of that type, which could still, for example, require exponential time. Okay, so that's a sort of mildly negative evaluation. It's a test that you can only fail just because you're contextual doesn't mean there's an advantage. So this is a second piece of work that's related to this, which is the thing that drives, that you worry about, that keeps you up at night about VQE, is the number of separate measurements you have to do. So this is sort of the number of measurements you have to make per step of this algorithm, okay? As a function of the number of spin orbitals, effectively the number of qubits. So pretty much everything on this plot is classically simulatable. It's not worth spending money to build a quantum computer to do any of these calculations. If you look at the Google supremacy paper, this is the level of sampling that they were doing in 200 seconds on Sycamore. You can see this is not very interesting chemistry problems. And then it goes up to sort of 6 years of that kind of sampling for one step of the algorithm, which nobody in the world is going to do.
Why are there many dots on top of each other?
Because there are many different molecules with the same number of spin orbitals.
Okay. So why is it 6 years?
Because it's a million times.
Sorry, on the y-axis, number of circuits.
Yes.
So that's to get the error down by averaging.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So you mean it's like single shot repetitions?
Yeah. Yep. I should really just say nobody's ever going to do that. So that's the takeaway. Okay, so let's go back to our picture. So for every one of those dots, this is what you're doing: you're estimating a single poly. So we always just draw a green box saying measurement. Of course, in an actual experiment, you're always going to measure in the Z, the basis of single Zs, okay? Because there's some actual physical measurement on a single qubit that you're going to perform. So there's always hidden in here some Clifford unitary you're doing to map the log weight poly to some Z measurement. So then the sort of obvious thing to do is to say, well, I want to reduce the number of terms. So now I'm going to stick in some non-Clifford unitary, which can have the property that it maps more than one poly to a single poly. This is like the infinitesimal amount of contextuality that's in this part of the talk. And then do the same thing. So now what I want to do is estimate this instead of estimating a whole bunch of poly terms. And now you've got to ask, when can I do that? So I just want to take the sum on the right, which is some set of Pauli terms in my Hamiltonian, and I want to reduce it to the operator on the left. So there's obviously an algebraic constraint, because if I square that operator, I get the identity. So the sum has to square to the identity, which implies that. And so it's sufficient to choose these sets to be L2 normalized to 1 and to be made up of sets of Paulis that completely anti-commute. So we can take the Hamiltonian, divide it into sets of completely anti-commuting operators. So these correspond to independent sets in the compatibility graph. The reducing unitary, you can write down what it is. There's no sort of hidden complicated unitary that's doing this. The only thing that you need to do is to find a good enough coloring of the compatibility graph. Now, of course, graph coloring is an NP-complete problem, but it turns out for these typical things, you can do well enough with classical heuristics, so that's not really an obstacle. So if you look at some numerics for the same set of data, same set of molecules that were for the other plot, what you see is this is the reduction, the fractional reduction in the number of terms. So what you get is, this is just some rough data, but it seems that you can reduce the number of terms from scaling like n to the fourth to scaling like n cubed. And so then the question is, can you establish this rigorously? And then Akimasa in June, when we were both at Duke, came up and said, I think you can prove this with Majorana fermions, which then Akimasa and his student, Andrew Zhao, then did. So then this is the result. So this blue line is the analytic bound from the Majorana terms, and the other dots are sort of various kinds of numerics based on different mappings. So it is in fact the case that you can reduce from n to the fourth measurements to n cubed measurements, which is quite nice. However, if you were paying attention to the archive in August, you will notice that this is one of only about 35 papers on measurement reduction in VQE that appeared. So this is not the best way to do it. However, the nice thing about this is it's sort of something simple that you can do now. Akimasa and I are both funded on this project from NSF, which is called STAC. And the goal is to build a 32-qubit ion trap by the end of the year. At the moment, we have one ion in the trap.
The year or by the end of the project?
Sorry.
You said by the end of the year, that's like 4 weeks.
Oh, you know, the funding year.
Okay.
Yeah, so at the end of the academic year, I think. So, you know, the thought of 32 qubits is kind of scary. So we're sort of hopeful that we can implement some of these techniques in experiments next year. Of course, the goal of this is to have an oligarch-free quantum computer. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say. I've finished extremely early, so I hope you will enjoy your lengthened coffee break. So the one more thing that I wanted to say was, if you take this measurement reduction technique and you apply it to a Hamiltonian that looks like this, i.e. a non-contextual one, you can ask what happens. Well, what happens is that you can make your anti-commuting terms by picking one term from each of these cliques in the compatibility graph. Each of these sets will anti-commute. You can then rotate each term back to the one in the first clique. And so you end up with a unitary partitioning of your Hamiltonian in which the terms commute. And so you get a reduction from a non-contextual Hamiltonian to a commuting Hamiltonian, which is kind of satisfying. Okay, so this is Will Kirby. He's another person from Williams called William, which always helps in quantum information. Andrew Trenton, my postdoc, Akimasa, who's here. Andrew Zhao, who's his student. And thank you for your attention.
Are there any questions?
Yes.
So a very stupid question. The contextuality of a Hamiltonian, is that a property of the Hamiltonian, or is it a property of some way you decided to translate the fermionic operators to qubits? Or what? Is it
intrinsic? Yeah, this is a good question. So,
if I do a different whatever Jordan Wigner, would I then can I like uncontextualize or?
No, I don't think so. Sorry.
Can I just ask the level of the fermionic operators before you even do a transformation? It's like cheating.
Sorry.
Well, yeah, so.
Could you ask the question just on the level of the fermionic operators before you even do the transformation?
Yeah, you could.
That's not what we did here because we wanted to analyze the experiments they actually did. But what you would probably do is just do the Majorana mapping and then do it at the level of the Majorana mapping. That would be the most, the quickest way of doing it.
Can I ask? Why do you care about contextuality of the Hamiltonian versus contextuality of the circuit?
Oh, it's because contextuality of the circuit's too hard.
Okay.
So this was the simplest thing that we could think of to start with, to try and make a connection between the two things. And then it, you know, sort of blossomed out into a bunch of interesting stuff. For example, in QAOA, where the initial Hamiltonian is commuting, you can imagine propagating the classical objective function backwards through the circuit like you do in the, like you always do in the analysis, and then asking questions about the resulting terms that you get there. And we haven't done that for the, you know, for the obvious reason that it's more work than doing this. But I think so the questions that we have in mind now are, you know, once we finish writing down this classical algorithm based on quasi-quantization, then the two obvious questions are to ask, well, how well does that do if you just throw away if you just take any problem in chemistry, say, and chuck out the terms and make it non-contextual, doesn't fill you with optimism. That's going to be a good approximation, but it would be interesting to go look and see what it gets correct. And then, of course, the other question would be, you know, in the spirit of your work with Sergei, you know, how do you use that as a sort of order zero approximation and add corrections to it?
What does string homotopy mean here? Does it mean QCD simulation?
No. So, yeah, what do they do there? So that's a 1+1 dimensional Schwinger model, which is, so it's like having a Dirac field and then you have pair production as well. So it's just a very toy model simulation of some high energy physics problem.
So, you know, in the context of the measurement reduction, do you know what's going on regarding contextuality? If we measure, you know, the monotone contextuality, do we actually decrease? Or the context doesn't change by doing this measurement reduction?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't think I can say anything intelligent about that. I just don't know. My guess would be if you had some. I mean, my guess would be it would go up, right? Because the transformations that you're making at the end have to have some resource in them, and that would tend to increase the contextuality of the measure.
Oh, you think?
I think that's the right answer. I think that's...
Any other questions? If I understand correctly, the kind of flavor of the contextuality here that you mentioned early on, that the obstacle to minimizing the energy in Hamiltonian is that although you might do it term by term, there's no guarantee that those reduced states were the marginals of some global state. So there's a difference between the classical marginal problem, is there a joint distribution over hidden variables that can reproduce these, and the quantum version of that marginal problem, is there a joint quantum state? And so contextuality here is kind of the gap between what you can do with quantum marginals versus what you can do with classical marginals.
I think that would be the gap between having a contextual ansatz and having a non-contextual ansatz. So I think that's the resource that's present in the circuit, irrespective, because the. Because you could ask the same question about QAOA, for example. But you know, if there is some quantum state that gives you a better approximation to a classical objective function than you can achieve with a classical algorithm, then you know the reduced density matrices of that state shouldn't be accessible by minimization without paying attention to that quantum marginal problem.
Any other questions? There are no more questions. Let's thank Peter again.